Hi, I'm Jen White, and this is the 1A Podcast. My next guest is a musical giant.
I've got another confession to make.
Searching for something, something never comes, never leads to nothing, nothing satisfies but
the sky is a neighborhood.
Dave Grohl's shadow looms large over the music industry. He's the founder of the 12-time Grammy Award-winning group Foo Fighters, and he was the drummer for the groundbreaking grunge band Nirvana. His musical footprint is matched only by the life he's led. In his new book, The Storyteller, Tales of Life and Music, Dave recounts some of his life-changing musical moments, from playing with legends like Iggy Pop and Tom Petty, to becoming a father and having rock icon Joan Jett read his daughter a bedtime story. We'll jump right into our conversation with Dave Grohl in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Dave, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Doing okay. I mean, as we talk about in the book, you've been moving at what feels like warp speed for most of your life, but the pandemic gave you a moment to sit down and write. What was that experience like?
Well, I've always been very active and kind of creatively restless. So ever since I was young, when I started playing music, I was obsessed with my record collection. I was obsessed with the instruments I was learning to play. Every waking moment was really spent trying to solve this mystery of musicality, and just to try. I always had an instrument in my lap, and when I started playing in bands, you know, the idea was to just keep moving forward. You know, you start a band, you write a song, you play a show, you record something, you make your own album, and you take it to the record store and put it on consignment. And, you know, I've felt that way ever since. And so with the Foo Fighters today, we've been really, really busy for 26 years, and I wouldn't have it any other way. So when the pandemic hit and everybody just kind of stopped and the world shut its doors, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to lose my mind. I have nothing to do. I've never had nothing to do. So I decided to start this Instagram page, which I'd never done. And instead of like fill it full of pictures and lifestyle kind of stuff, I thought, well, I'll just write some stories about these incredible experiences I've had, just to sort of give someone 3 or 4 minutes of happiness in an otherwise dreary day. And then once I realized I was going to be here for a while, I thought, okay, maybe I'll finally sit down and write a book. So I did.
When you talk about trying to answer that question of musicality, what is that question? Is it, what is musicality? Is it something else?
Well, you know, both of my parents were musicians. My mother sang in an a cappella group in the 50s. Our family's from northeastern Ohio. My father was a classically trained flautist. And so I really do believe in like this hereditary theory, this DNA that's kind of passed down from generation to generation. And so when I started playing music, I didn't learn from teachers. I was learning by ear. And I would listen to albums and try to play along with them. So that in itself was its own puzzle. But, you know, there's this condition that's called synesthesia, where like some like wires can be crossed and you can see sound. And I don't necessarily think I have that, but when I would hear music, it was like shapes in my head. And so if I listened to a song, it was almost like the Legos I was playing with when I was a kid. You know, the arrangement of a song was built in the same way I would build little houses or little cars. You know, they were different colors and different shapes. And so I think that just sort of lent to this obsession where it wasn't only something I was listening to, it was something I was seeing in my mind. And I still feel the same way. Like I can't shake it. Even as we're having this conversation right now, if there were a song playing in the background, I could carry on this conversation with you, but I would be seeing the shapes of the drum pattern from the song in the background in my head. So, I mean, I see it as a blessing and a curse. You know, it's almost like it's almost like an affliction. I just feel like, oh my God, can I just stop thinking about music for 5 seconds?
Well, it's curious to me because if you're listening to a song and as you were growing up, listening to music and deconstructing what you're hearing, that pattern makes a lot of sense to me, that your brain would look at it in that way.
Yes.
How does it work when you're writing?
Well, okay, I remember the day that I realized music was a composition of multiple elements. My mother and I were driving, this is in the 70s, I grew up in Virginia outside of DC. We were driving to the lake where we would always go swimming. And Carly Simon's You're So Vain came on the radio. And my mother and I used to sing along to songs all the time. Then the chorus came around and I was singing the Mick Jagger part. And my mom was singing the Carly Simon part. And it broke off into harmony. And it was in that moment that I realized, oh my God, two different notes form a chord. And that's where that separation began, where I'm like, oh my God, and the kick drum does this thing, and then there's a keyboard, and then there's some saxophone, whatever. So that's where I really started to think about composition and arrangement. And as I was sitting on my bedroom floor with my Beatles songbook, listening to Beatles albums, playing along, feeling like I'm the fifth Beatle, you know, like thinking like I'm in the Beatles right now, it made me pay more attention to their craft and how they wrote songs and the chords that they used and the transition from a verse to a chorus and things like that. I mean, that was my fascination, was deconstructing the puzzle. Like, which piece is missing? Oh, this goes there. And it was great, especially for, you know, as a kid, I played sports and stuff. I was a horrible student. You know, had I not had music, I don't know what I would have done after the school bell rang. But what I did was I went back to my bedroom floor and studied these albums and learned to play an instrument.
Well, and you learned to play the drums on pillows. You only had one formal lesson. And in reading about those early years for you playing, what came through to me was desperation may be too strong a word, but you were really reaching for something and you were finding it in music. Do you know what that was? What the thing was you were reaching for?
Well, first of all, my mother was a public school teacher for 35 years. So she raised my sister and I on her meager public school teacher salary. So we didn't have much. You know, we didn't have the money for a drum set. We didn't have the money for lessons. So in a way, I don't know if I would call it desperation, but I did need to do this and by any means necessary. So if I wanted to learn to play the drums, all I really needed was a pair of drumsticks, some pillows, and a record. And I was just kind of doing this by ear.
Your love of music begins with punk rock. You were introduced to the genre by a family member, and a family friend, rather, in Chicago. And here's a clip of you reading a passage from your audiobook about that awakening.
This was a feeling of freedom that I had waited for my entire life. And now that I'd been baptized by spit and sweat and broken glass, there was no turning back. Song after thunderous song, I kept close to the small stage, bathed in the distorted glory of the music. Naked Raygun is considered by some to be the most important band in the history of Chicago punk, and their style almost resembled a hardcore Dick Dale type of surf rock. Of course, I didn't understand their relevance then. I just knew that this music was filling my head and my soul with something I needed more of. With no song longer than about 3.5 minutes, each stuttered blast was met with a riotous response, and the pauses between songs seemed like an eternity as I waited for the chaos to resume. It was all over much too soon, and as the house lights came up, I walked over to the merchandise table and bought my first punk rock record, Naked Raygun's flammable solid 7-inch single, one of only 1,000 made. After the gig, we boarded the train and returned to Evanston with ears ringing and hearts made anew. In one summer day, I was forever changed, and now understood that I didn't need the pyrotechnics, lasers, or impossible proficiency of a virtuoso instrumentalist to become a musician. The most important element of rock and roll had been revealed to me in Naked Raygun's performance. The raw and imperfect sound of human beings purging their innermost voice for all to hear. This was now available to me.
You'd been exposed to all kinds of music when you were growing up, but just hearing that passage, punk woke something up in you. And now that you're further along in life and you have a chance to reflect, beyond just the musicality of what you were hearing, emotionally, what did it connect to for you?
I think that same feeling that I had when I was a kid doing it by myself on the bedroom floor with my albums, you know, when I saw how simple and real this music was, I did feel like it was accessible. Like, I felt like I could do this as well. It really was a huge, huge moment for me because I don't know if I knew who I was yet at that point. I was maybe 13 years old. And, you know, just as most kids, you haven't really figured it out. But, you know, there is this theory that my mother explained to me once that there's this golden window of opportunity in every child's life in between the ages of about 10 and 13, where identity and independence intersect. So you're no longer just like arm candy, something that's, you know, your parents are holding hands with as you cross the street. You're becoming who you become. And if you have any sort of musical inclination in that time, you sort of decide, okay, I'm going to be a musician. And this particular event, going to see this punk rock show, fell right in that golden window of opportunity. And it may have been my life's first real inspiration. So it sent me in a direction where I thought, I know those four chords. They only know four chords. I know four chords. They're writing about how they feel. I can write about how I feel. I know some people with instruments. We're not the greatest band in the world, but for whatever reason, you know, music used to be this sound that just kind of moved the air. And then it became the air that I breathed. I was like, okay, this is what I need to do to survive. So, you know, now as I have three daughters and I'm watching them grow up and experience music, I try to encourage them to do it themselves and to realize that it is that real, raw, imperfect element of music that's most important, that they should find their voice and be themselves. And it's inspiring to watch them do it as well.
throughout the book, we hear these stories of you just having this kind of fantastic luck connecting with your musical heroes. You got that drumming gig with your punk dream band Scream. Iggy Pop asks you to play a gig with them. You get interest from Nirvana when they need a drummer. When you look back, how do you make sense of those moments?
Don't. I can't. As I was writing this book, I mean, honestly, it's almost like the book is written from the perspective of someone who's watching all of this happen to someone else. Because it's just, I mean, to be honest, it's just weird. Like, it's that these things happen. I don't take any of it for granted, because I'm like, I can't believe I was standing outside of LAX having a smoke, and a guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, I read in an interview that the only person you ever wanted to meet was Little Richard." And I said, "Well, of course. I mean, he's the originator. He's the innovator. If it weren't for Little Richard, there'd be no rock and roll." And this guy says, "Well, he's my dad." And I'm like, "What?" And he goes, "And he's sitting in this car right here by the curb." What a coinkydink, you know? And I walk over to the car. He taps on the window comes down, and it's Little Richard. And I'm face to face with the man that invented rock and roll. And so it's moments like that where, like, okay, you make sense of that. Does that make any sense?
No.
But that's, is like, it just, it's filled with a lot of those moments. And you know, as I write about them, like they're great anecdotes, like, oh, and then I met Little Richard and then I got to jam with Prince or whatever. But there's an emotional relevance to every single one of these stories that, that not only makes the story worthwhile, but makes the experience to me, more than just bumping into a legend. It's like, if it were, I will have the full circle while it's happening. And it's almost like, you know, people say that before you die, your life flashes before your eyes and there's all these amazing moments. Well, in those moments, I think, oh, this is one of them. Oh yeah. Like, this is what I'm going to see right before I pass. It's going to be one of these. And they keep happening over and over and over again.
We'll be back with more from Dave in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to our conversation with 16-time Grammy-winning musician Dave Grohl. I would imagine you get a lot of young musicians who come to you for advice. And in reading the book and reading about these remarkable coinkydinks that you've sort of stumbled over, how do you talk to them about the reality of building a musical career, that you can't rely on these just once in a lifetime things, or in your life, it may be 7 or 10 times in a lifetime coincidences that crop up, but there's this whole grind that you also have to put in to building a successful career.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, the one thing that carries you and helps you survive a lot of those difficult moments is just the core love of music and playing. And that's really where it should all begin. Because at the end of the day, then it's its own reward in a way. You know, I think that that a lot of musicians might have expectations of what they could achieve or what comes next. And, you know, that can be dangerous because there really is no guarantee that it will ever pay off, quote unquote. But I think if you remind yourself of that core love of music and that you have that, it can save your life. You know, if when you're starving and you're nowhere to sleep and you're in a van with 10 people and you're in a snowstorm and, you know, it's the love of music that keeps you there. Most other people, if you don't have that, you're just going to get a bus ticket home.
Well, speaking of difficult times, you write about what life was like living with Kurt Cobain during the making of the Nevermind album. You were in a self-described squalid den of filth in Washington State and living off of gas station corn dogs. Describe that time for us.
I mean, living in Olympia, Washington, when I first moved up there, I didn't know Chris or Kurt. We had never met. So our first meeting was them picking me up from the airport, and I had my drums in a big box and a duffel bag. So I wouldn't say that I felt lost. I knew why I was there. But I definitely, there were moments where I felt alone because I had just kind of thrown away my previous life and rolled the dice to go up there and do it. You know, the greatest thing about that time was that we rehearsed a lot. We rehearsed maybe 5 days a week in this barn outside of Tacoma, Washington. And Kurt was really prolific. You know, at night we would come home from rehearsal and he would go into his room and he would write in his journals and maybe write some music. And then the next day in the barn, there'd be another song. And then we go back to the little apartment, which, I mean, it was total squalor. It was disgusting. Mm-hmm. Like, it really was. It was bad. But he would write and write and write. And we knew that we had an album coming. And we knew that we only had maybe 12 days to record it. So we wanted to be good. You know, that whole thing about Gen X and slackers and nobody, like, that wasn't Nirvana. Like, we were focused and we really wanted to be a great band. So we knew that at the end of every day, we had one more song to bring down to that studio Sound City to record. And then we'd have another song. And having such a short period of time to record it, we wanted to be great. It was a really exciting time. You know, of course, nobody had any idea what would happen next. But it was. We were young. I think I was 21. Kurt might have been 23. We really were just kids. And it was that sense of adventure that felt great. We were free, you know.
Well, you write about the struggle during Nirvana's rise with becoming mainstream. You write, quote, "We had always been the outcasts. We had always been the weirdos. We were not one of them. So how could they become one of us?" And the "they" is those more mainstream fans you were picking up. How do you think about that distinction today?
Well, you have to remember that we were sort of raised musically in this underground punk rock scene, which at times could be ethically suffocating. You know, we were conditioned to reject any sort of conformity, any sort of commercial aspect or success or anything like that. And I don't think we imagined we would be a part of that, like, top 40 world. But unfortunately, Kurt's songs were really great. And it didn't matter how old you were, what type of music you listened to, people really did connect with Kurt's songs. And there was once when we were looking for a record company and we were sitting in this, like, high-rise office in New York City with this famous record executive behind this huge oak desk. And he said, "Okay, well, what do you want?" And Kurt said, "We want to be the biggest band in the world." And I thought he was kidding. You know, I didn't think that that type of ambition was even an option. It was just, it just seems totally implausible at the time. I mean, you have to remember top 40 music at the time was, like, Mariah Carey, and it was Michael Bolton, and it was Wilson Phillips. Like, where does Nirvana fit into that scenario? It just doesn't. So when the band started selling a lot of records, you know, I think we felt that anchor that we had dropped in our punk rock scene, and we were kind of, like, being pulled against this mainstream tide where more and more people were coming to the shows, more and more people were buying the records, and we were becoming a really big band. And it happened in a really short period of time. It's a difficult thing for anybody to navigate emotionally. You know, still to this day, if I see a young artist becoming popular quickly, my initial reaction is concern, because it's really difficult to make your way through that unscathed. And it was hard to come to terms with that success, not only because of our punk rock background, but because of all the things that came with it. And I remember, like, my mother, when I went to go tour Europe in these squats, I would send her a postcard every 3 weeks, and I was, like, you know, traveling around with these punks, sleeping on floors and pirating electricity and things like that. My mother was actually more concerned for me when Nirvana became popular than she was when I was scumming around Europe with my punk rock buddies.
Well, after Kurt Cobain's death, you started to have a complicated relationship with music, and you write that what had been life's greatest joy became life's greatest sorrow. You took a break, but music seemed to keep bringing you back, and you got an opportunity to play with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and you started recording your own music. How did music help you after suffering such a loss?
Well, it always had. You know, that was the thing. Like, when I was a teenager, I didn't have a therapist. I had my records. Like, I wasn't going to church. My church was music. You know, I didn't have a lover or a best friend. Those were my artists that I listened to. So, you know, music had really helped me through a lot of difficult situations when I was young. And after Nirvana ended, it hurt just to hear it on the radio. But then I remembered, you know, it saved my life my entire life. Maybe it'll do it again. And so that's when I went back and picked up some instruments and started the Foo Fighters.
You have three daughters, Violet, Harper, and Ophelia. And you tell this fantastic story of picking up a Joan Jett Barbie for your daughters and then your daughters meeting her in person. Can you tell us a bit of that story?
Yeah, I mean, there was a day off in London and we were all over there on tour. It was a rainy day. And so I couldn't take the kids to the park. We weren't going to go outside. I think we'd been to a few museums. I said, you know what, let's go to Harrods. Okay, we get to Harrods, the famous department store. Yeah. Their toy section in that store is like, it's like the size of LaGuardia. It's giant. It's just a huge, huge toy section. I said, okay, you have 1 hour. You could pick one toy and it has to fit in your luggage. Go. And so they'd scurry off and I set my timer. And after an hour, they're stuck in the Barbie section because there's 10 million Barbies and they can't pick one. And I said, you guys, time to go. We got to go. They're like, but Dad, we can't pick one. And I looked down and I picked up a Barbie and it was a Joan Jett Barbie. With black t-shirt, white guitar, Converse Chucks, leather pants. And I said, look, I got a Barbie. Okay, let's go. They're like, you can't get a Barbie. Anyway, so we wind up back at the hotel room. And they say, Dad, can we play with your Barbie? And I said, yeah, sure. And then I said, you know, this is a real person, you know. This is Joan Jett. She's an icon. She's a hero. And I played them the I Love Rock and Roll video, and they fell in love and whatever. Well, not long after that, Joan came to play with the Foo Fighters at a show at Madison Square Garden, and we decided we wanted to write songs with each other. So we made this date that she was going to come to Los Angeles, stay in the guest house, and we'd write songs for the weekend. So I told the girls, remember that Barbie? Well, she's coming. Okay, she's real. This is a real person. So when she gets here, don't freak out because she's cool. So, of course, she met. They were awestruck. Just they couldn't believe that this was real. But then that night, as I was getting Violet ready for bed, she said, Dad, I want Joan Jett to read me bedtime stories. And I looked at Joan, who was in her pajamas, and I said, hey, Joan, will you read bedtime stories to Violet? She's like, sure, Violet, okay, come on. And I watched the two of them walk upstairs, and I thought, I hope Violet remembers this. I hope that she realizes that some superheroes are real. And the last line in that story is actually my favorite line in the whole book. I said, "For in a world full of Barbies, every girl needs a Joan Jett."
You talked about how you think about music as these sort of pieces that you're trying to get to fit together. And you also said that when you were growing up, music was everything. Music was your best friend. Music was your lover. But now you're a dad. You've got these three girls who you're raising. How do all those pieces fit together today? Dave, the father, Dave, the musician, and all the other pieces of you that are at play.
I think they only see me as their dad. Of course, they've seen me on stage. They've seen me make the documentaries. And then now they're watching me write a book and things like that. But at the end of the day, I don't think they see that. I think they see the person that, you know, drives them to school or changes the batteries in their Walkman or makes the pancakes or whatever it is. I think that, you know, when I come home, all of that other stuff just kind of disappears. And I'm just their dad. It's just the way it is.
And what about for you? How do those pieces fit together for you?
Well, it's, you know, it's a really important balance because the Foo Fighters is a really big part of my life. But it's not as big as the family. It's, you know, I feel so fortunate that I have both because it's that kind of balance that if this one goes completely insane, well, then this is the thing that'll heal it. If this thing gets totally out of control, well, then this is the thing that's going to bring me back down to earth. So it kind of works in that way.
So you fell in love with punk music for its rawness and those imperfections. Of course, music production has changed. The landscape of music has shifted dramatically. Where do you see punk and rock music's legacy today?
You know, I feel like it's the same. I think it's the same as it's always been. I mean, it's kind of hard to define. Like it's a long standing debate over what punk rock means. And ultimately, it should just mean like freedom of expression. Like who's to say what to wear? Who's to say what to sound like? Who's to say what to say? Like it should just be sort of this free and open space to be yourself. And you know, today, of course, we use different tools to record music. We use different ways to distribute music. But I think it's that, you know, it's that, again, it's that core that that defines what you do. It's not even necessarily how you do it. It's why you do it. And I don't think that why will ever change. I think that most musicians have the same why.
That's Dave Grohl. We spoke to him about his new book, The Storyteller, Tales of Life and Music. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.